Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. It's June 20, 2022. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Rod Stafford, who just happens to be the lead pastor at Portland Mennonite Church. Welcome, Rod. I'm so glad that we finally got around to having you on my program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We start at the beginning, and I've known you for about 23 years, but there's still a lot of things I don't know about you. But I'm pretty sure that you were not born in Oregon. Could you tell us where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in California, in Central California, in Lodi, between Stockton and Sacramento. If you ever remember Creedence Clearwater Revival stuck in Lodi, that's the Lodi they were singing about. So that's where I'm from.
Was that a home area for either of your parents, or what's the story there?
My father, except for a year he was in college, finishing a degree, has lived in Lodi his entire 84 years, and my mother came there as a teenager. So that's been home turf for our family for a long time now.
And so you actually grew up there as well?
I did, until I went off to college. Lived in California my entire life until I went to a church at, age 33 in Kansas. So, yeah.
How many siblings do you have, and where do you fit in the family?
There were three of us. I'm the oldest. And then I have a brother who's 2 years younger. He's an orthodontist in the East Bay, Pleasanton. And then we had a sister. She was the youngest. Deneen, she died about 11 years ago now from kidney cancer. So that was a really difficult time for our family.
California, I think of that as being warm. Maybe it's not always warm, but as a young child growing up, what kinds of things did you do, say, in your neighborhood for fun in, say, elementary school?
Sure. Well, where I grew up, it was actually hot. The Central Valley can get really hot in the summer. It's dry heat, but still pretty hot. Oh, we would just ride our bikes endlessly. We'd play at the school playground. For a while, we lived next to a vineyard. There's a vineyard behind our back fence, and they had the irrigation system had a big sort of earthen gathering place, and it was like a swimming pool if you were a kid. So we'd play in the irrigation ditches of the vineyards. We try to be outside a lot. I looked like, I don't know if you remember, but there used to be, people used to put on lotion to get suntanned instead of to try to keep from being suntanned. That copper tone kid, I looked like that copper tone kid where he had his dog pulling down his trunks in the back. That was me when I was growing up. I worry about skin cancer now, but back then it seemed like a good idea.
And is it safe to say that your parents didn't always know where you were when you were outside playing?
Yeah, I'm sure. In some cases, I was glad they didn't know, so yes.
And did you live in town, or were you out in the country?
We lived on a country lane while I was in fourth grade. Then when we moved into the house that my father built or designed, we lived in town, yeah.
And what kind of work were your parents doing?
My dad was an engineer for General Mills. So when they needed a new product line, he would design it and have the equipment brought in and so on. So he worked for General Mills his entire life. My mother stayed home. So pretty traditional gender roles when I was growing up. But she was a very gifted, and still is, seamstress. And so she would take in work. There would often be women in a back room being fitted for a dress she would sew the dresses for entire wedding parties, actually. And that's how she always had a little bit of money in her pocket too. So. Yeah.
Did you go to public school in those early days?
Yes, I always went to public school until seminary, actually. So Houston School and Vinewood School and Senior L and Lodi High School, the Flames. So, yeah.
That sounds appropriate for a place that's hot.
It was actually named after, there's a variety of grape, the Flame Tokay. It's very prominent in that area, red grape. So I think that was what the Flames referenced, but yeah.
Did you walk to school or take a bus? How did you get there?
Well, we lived in the country. We took a bus, but in town, school is not far. We walked, and then in high school, we just ride our bikes. Although by the time we all got our licenses, there were a couple of pretty girls who had cars, and I would try to walk in certain ways so that they would perhaps see me on the way to school and give me a ride. And occasionally that was successful.
I was actually going to say, so tell me about your first car. But first of all, you were looking for young girls or young women who actually had cars. That's an interesting twist.
You know, it worked. I didn't own a car until I graduated from college. So just drive my dad's cars. My first car was a Honda, used Honda Civic. It's a very efficient, pretty reliable car. Remarkably uninteresting, but it got me where I needed to go. And I drove it, I mean, literally into the ground. So
as you were going to school, let's say in junior high, getting into high school, at what point did you start to realize that certain subjects were more interesting than others, or that you had more of a bent toward them, or you found them challenging? Talk a bit about academics in those years.
Yeah, I was always a good student. I was a good little boy, and I was not the smartest kid, but my temperament fit school, and I learned how to take tests really well too. So I always got good grades. I was like math. I liked the it's either right or wrong. So I like that. Plus, I often got very good grades. In high school, I had a chemistry class, and the teacher was quite good, and it was fascinating. And so I kind of gravitated toward chemistry when I was in high school. And of course, a lot of math as well, but a little more on that side. I hung out with the nerds.
What extracurricular activities were you involved in high school?
Oh, these are really good questions. I was in band the first 2 years. I played cornet, trumpet, a version of trumpet. So I was in band for, I guess, 2 years. I was pretty good, not great. To be honest, I got tired of selling candy, so I decided I was going to be done with band. They were always selling candy to buy new uniforms. I was on the wrestling team for a year, for two reasons. I had friends who were on wrestling team. I'd never done this before, and I was very small. And so I went out for wrestling, and I was the only guy who could make the lowest weight. At that time, the lowest weight category was 95 pounds. And I only weighed 92 pounds, so I didn't have to lose weight at all. And we had a very good team. In California, we had fellas who would wrestle at the state tournament. So it was quite a good team. But I was the only kid who was small enough to wrestle. So I actually got a varsity letter my freshman year. But the coach would send me out there, and his only instruction was, try not to get pinned, Stafford. He had no hopes for me winning anything, but he just tried to limit the damage as much as possible. So I did that for a year. The second year, I was going to have to lose weight. He wanted me to get down to 95 from 101. And I don't know, you know, lying on the floor wrestling with sweaty guys for hours at a time and having to lose weight to do it didn't seem all that appealing. So that's when I decided I was going to take up snow skiing with my other friends. So after that, took up skiing. And then, you know, church for us was real central. So a lot of time was spent at church and with youth group and all those kind of activities as well. So, yeah.
Perfect segue. That was going to be my next question. Talk a little bit about church. So what kind of church were you attending?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, church was really central to our family. A lot of I was in Boy Scouts and played Little League and all that stuff. But church was a real central part of our life. It wasn't a Mennonite church. It's actually a Pentecostal church. Bethel Open Bible Church. So Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, we always missed the Disney show on Sunday night was. I never saw that because we were always at church Wednesday night for prayer meetings and often, you know, youth group on the weekend. So, and it was kind of old school Pentecostal. It was people speaking in tongues and somebody interpreting in the service, or Sunday nights would be people being slain in the spirit. And so it was kind of that old unvarnished version of Pentecostalism. I would say I was not a very good Pentecostal. I'm not very demonstrative, and that's a fairly demonstrative sort of expression of faith. I never really quite got the hang of speaking in tongues. Like, that was pretty important. And I know it was meaningful for some people. I just never quite figured it out. And there was some parts of it that just didn't make sense to me. I mean, I knew it was odd, for one thing, people raising their hands and falling over. So I never invited my friends. But there was parts of it I didn't quite just get either. I mean, there's kind of some prosperity gospel, and that just didn't make sense to me. I mean, there would be missionaries or people come from India, for example. And I knew that they were devout, and they also seemed poor as dirt. So for some reason, why was God not blessing them if it was supposed to work that way? So that being said, you know, we had a lot of relatives there. My grandparents went there, Sunday school teachers. It was a very loving church. I think for that reason, for those folks, and, you know, for my parents and certainly my father, it's never been hard for me to believe that God loves me. And, you know, that God loves me like a father. And I know that's a limited image, but for a son, and given my dad, that's been a real gift.
Was it always understood by you and or your parents that the next step after high school would be college? What was that story?
Yeah, it was. My mom didn't go to college. My dad, he went to a community college, and he went to a state college for a year, and then he finally went to Berkeley for a year. And so we'd go over there to go to football games, and being on a campus, you know, that just seemed kind of normal. So, and I was a good student, so yeah, I always assumed I would go to college.
So where did you go and who paid?
So as I said, my dad went to Cal Berkeley, and I never imagined going anywhere. I just assumed I would get in, and I assumed I would go there, which in retrospect was kind of a foolish assumption, but I did get in. And I went, and you know, this was in the 70s, and Berkeley in the 60s had been, you know, the home of some radical student movements, Students for Democratic Society and Mario Savio and all those folks. And so I do remember there was a Sunday school teacher or two, so these older women, just sweet and loving, but they let me know when they heard that I was going to go to Berkeley that they would be praying for me. And I think in retrospect, their fears kind of came true, because what, you know, what's become of me and my understanding of Christianity and faith and life probably would be a little bit at odds and maybe a little shocking to them. But I'm glad for their prayers anyway. Let's see, who paid for it? Mostly me. I mean, you know, back at the time, it's hard for me to believe this is true, but I think my first year at Cal, the total cost was $1,250. That was everything, because there was no tuition. It was a state university. There were some reg fees, and then the dorm wasn't that expensive, and I'd gotten some scholarships and whatever. So, but it was really, compared to today, it's shocking how inexpensive it was. And I worked summer jobs and got a few scholarships and borrowed a little bit of money. And every now and then I'd call home and say, Dad, I could really use a little bit of money here. So it was never a threat that I wasn't going to be able to get by or have to withdraw or skip a semester or anything like that. And I don't recall having a huge debt when I left, but.
And you did live in the dorm?
For 2 years. Yeah. For 2 years in the dorm, and then for 2 years in an apartment. So yeah, it was a shift. I mean, Lodi was kind of a smaller, you know, it's more of a farming town really. And then Berkeley was kind of the big city, but it's a fun place.
I'm sure there are lots of stories that we don't have time to go into about all of that. But at what point in your college career, and I assume you were planning to do a four-year college, did you decide on a major? And where did that come from? You had talked a bit about your interest in math and science, but.
You know, I college was always kind of a given. The school I went to, you know, a fair number went to college, but it wasn't really a college prep. I liked chemistry, and I thought engineers made money, so I thought, I'll just become a chemical engineer. And that was the only logic. I didn't know you could be an economist. I didn't know you could study sociology or archaeology. It was a kind of a practical decision. So I was a chemical engineering major for 2 years. I remember in organic chemistry, second year, tough class. I was not doing all that well. I finally went into the prof's office for office hours because I had a question. And when I walked in, there was a large table in his office, and there were 12, I recognized him, there were 12 students sitting around that table. And I realized that every time he had office hours, they would go there and just talk chemistry with him. And I realized, I do not care about chemistry that much, and I'm never going to care that much. I'm not going to care for a career that much. I need to rethink this. So, for a variety of reasons, I ended up in political science, which all my chemistry friends called pre-unemployment, and they were basically kind of right about that. So that was a pretty significant shift. Studied politics for 2 years and got a degree in political science. So how about that? Which I think Harold got his degree in, too. And my daughter got her degree in it, too. So
you're in good stead.
That's right.
So was it a BA or a BS?
A BA. Yeah. Yeah. And it was infinitely easier than chemical engineering. The average grade was a C, and you had to go to labs. And political science, the average grade was a B and there was no labs. My life just got a lot easier.
And was church still a part of your life during those 4 years in college?
You know, I was involved in a campus ministry. I do remember when I went to college, for the first time I realized I was going to decide for myself whether Christianity was really just for kids and grandmas or if it was for me. And so I went to, I did get involved in a campus ministry, and that proved to be pretty meaningful for me. I would go to church occasionally. I wouldn't say I was a regular churchgoer. I went to First Presbyterian. There's a pastor there named Earl Palmer. He was a very good preacher. It was a very different church experience than I mean, they had a choir that sang Bach. I'm like, where did that come from? And he would wear a robe. But he also was very, you know, Pentecostalism when I grew up was, it wasn't exactly anti-intellectual, but that wasn't a big part of it. There was a suspicion about going to college and learning a little too much, taking the sting out of your faith a little bit. But Earl Palmer was a graduate of Cal, and he was very comfortable in the church and the academy. And he would quote, you know, Dorothy Sayers and C.S. Lewis. And it was a whole different version. I think it gave me a vision of a different kind of the possibility of a different kind of Christian faith that could incorporate my mind as well as my heart. So that was pretty meaningful, even though I didn't go there all that much. And I'm sure he wouldn't recognize me from Adam, but that was meaningful.
So you graduate with this wonderful degree in political science with a plan to do what, where?
Yeah, good question. So when I graduated, I actually was awarded a Senate fellowship at the California State Senate, not in the U.S., but I was a Senate fellow in Sacramento, so I got to work at the Capitol. So I went up there, and I figured I'll just learn a little more about politics. It's kind of a long story, but the senator that I was assigned to turned out to be actually, he was a criminal. He eventually got stung by the FBI on some bribery. So it was a very interesting experience to work in his office. I could talk about that for a while. It wasn't just that, but it felt a little too remote from things I was starting to care about. And so that's when I kind of reevaluated. Our church had some missionaries in Haiti. So I went down there for 6 weeks and lived with them just to get a sense of the part of the world and what other possibilities. I was starting to circle around. I wanted to do something more directly related to living out my faith. So I did that.
How long were you actually working there in Sacramento?
Oh, so I was in Sacramento for a year and a half. And at the end of that, that's when I was kind of reevaluating whether I wanted to continue on. So that's when I went off to Haiti just to tag along for 6 weeks with some folks there. And I came back, and I don't know, it took me a couple of years to kind of think things through. I just was a substitute teacher for a while and went skiing in the winter. And eventually decided I'd go to seminary just to try to kind of think about my faith, what I believed, what mattered to me, figure out what could come next. But I grew up in a tradition where nobody went to seminary, so I didn't know what to do. I went to one seminary in Southern California for a year, and within a week I knew it was the wrong place, but, you know, stick it out for a year.
And can you say which one that was? Are you okay saying that?
No, it was a Talbot Seminary. It was part of Biola. It's just, I don't know, the approach to education didn't suit me. Their version of Christianity I was kind of moving away from. So then I went to Fuller Seminary, which is kind of a broadly evangelical seminary. And there was some Anabaptist influence there at the time, and I think still is. I would say Fuller was, for more conservative Christians at that time, it was known as the F word. There was a little bit of concern about the liberalism of that place, which for liberals, they would look and be a little concerned about the conservatism of that place. But it was a good place for me. So
when you decided to go, we'll say, to Fuller, because obviously you had decided that seminary was something that you were interested in, even though the first one didn't work out.
Yeah.
You went to seminary somewhere else. At what point in all of that did it start to occur to you that this might be, quote unquote, a career? Or was it just that most of that time you were just kind of trying to, quote unquote, find yourself, figure out what mattered in life? Talk a bit about that process, if you could.
Sure. I think that over time, I was realizing that I think I could have been a teacher and probably a good teacher, but for whatever reason, that wasn't really, just didn't seem like the right thing. business was never all that interesting to me. So I think, actually, I remember at a seminary chapel one time, the speaker said, it was like 10 things that he wished he'd known in seminary, and I don't remember 9 of them, but one of them was, if you can do anything else, do it. That was one, his way, I think, of narrowing in on that sense of calling. And I think he referenced that line from the prophet Jeremiah, where Jeremiah's in the wilderness. He's mad at God, ready to walk away. But he says, it's like a fire in my bones and I have to let it out. And that's sort of how it feels like to me. It's like a fire in my bones. Like I can't really not do this. I'm sure if I needed to, I could do something else. But I think that was my sense of my emerging sense of calling. You know, truthfully, at seminary, I did an MDiv just because, I don't know, that's what you do at seminary, isn't it? And then they told me I was supposed to do an internship. And by then I was aware of this little Pasadena Mennonite group that was about a year and a half old. Jim Brenneman was the pastor. It was a church plant. It was a small group. And I still remember sitting down with him and saying, could I be an intern? And he looked at me like, you mean, can you work for us for free? Sure, you could do that. So I was the first intern there. And I started to realize that I like this. It's meaningful. I'm actually kind of decent at it. And then there was a point where I realized, wait a minute, I could get a job doing this? So I didn't go to seminary to be a pastor, and I didn't go to Mennonite because I didn't even know what that was. But yeah, the Lord works in mysterious ways sometimes. And so by the time I finished, I was on my way to being a Mennonite pastor. I should say, and this part people may not know, but that's where I met my wife. She had gone to seminary there as well. And I still remember the first moment I saw her. We were sitting in a class. It was on Islamic studies. And I looked across and thought, well, that looks like a pretty interesting woman. She has no recollection of me in that class at all. But hey, you know, it worked out, let's say. But as I was, you know, becoming a Mennonite and filling this call to pastoral ministry, we were getting together, you know, as a couple. And she was like, yeah, I'm not going to be a Mennonite, so don't even think about that possibility. And I'm not really interested in being a pastor's wife either. So we decided to get married anyway, and we'd figure it out as we go. But that's why I'm sure there's people at the church that have never met my wife. I reference her in sermons. She really does exist. She's a wonderful person. Yes, she
does. I have met her, and she does exist.
She's a remarkable person, but that's just sort of the way that we've worked it out. And I'm grateful to the church, and we're grateful that the church has sort of given us space to work it out for our relationship and for our family. So,
what was it about Anabaptists, Mennonites? Can you say a little bit about what it was?
Mm-hmm. When I was in college, I grew up in a church where the Bible was valued, you know, it was the authority for our lives. And so that was kind of always ingrained in me. When I was in college in this campus ministry, though, I came across, and this is a campus ministry that really eschewed politics. You know, they didn't want to focus on faith. They didn't want politics getting in the way. So there's this book that was being kind of furtively passed around. It was called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger by a guy named Ron Sider, who I wouldn't have known from Adam either. But concurrent with that was sort of, I think for me, an emerging kind of social consciousness. There's a lot to that story, but that's also why I went into politics. And that book, I learned, like I was a Mennonite author, I discovered, it was very biblical. And that part was familiar, but it was also very foreign because he was writing in a way and about things that just had never been part of my faith. He was drawn from parts of the Bible that we just apparently never read from. So I think that, and then another long story, but I ended up learning about Sojourners Magazine, which is another kind of another way, another vision or entry into another version of Christianity. So by the time I got to Fuller and met some Mennonites, and they invite me to their church, for me, it felt almost like home in the sense of they're really grounded in the scriptures, but they also hold this understanding of faith as having this social dimension, including a commitment to peacemaking and sort of an active living out of one's faith. So all of that stuff just kind of got set right for me. And yeah, ever since, here I am.
Well, there's so much more as always in these interviews, but we have to get you to Portland Mennonite. So I know that you first went to Kansas, right? Tell me just a little bit of that progression after you graduated from seminary. And
so I was on the staff there at Pasadena Mennonite for a year or two, just real part-time. And then life happens. And I remember beginning to look for a pastoral position and looking at maps, because I like national parks. I like to hike and camp. And just thinking, I want to go to a state with a national park. And Kansas has no national, they're not even close to national parks. But we ended up in Lawrence, Kansas, where the University of Kansas is. We were there for 7 years. That's where Laura was born. Wonderful town, wonderful friends, great place to sort of begin one's career as a pastor too. So we were there for 7 years. And
since you mentioned Laura, we have to mention Julia. Where was she born?
Julia was born when we were still in Southern California, living in Glendale. It's a whole other story, but we were living in a retirement community at the time. So she was a one-year-old, born and lived her first year in a retirement home, basically. And then Laura, born in Kansas. And it was hard for them to leave because that was the home they knew. But we, for a lot of reasons, moved to Portland. I mean, I'm from California. I was eager to come back to the West Coast. And it's a wonderful congregation. It's a little bit bigger. I was kind of tired of being the only person, the only staff person in a real small church. I mean, if anything, if there was going to be a bulletin, it's because I was going to make it happen and fold them all on Saturday night, all that stuff. So I was glad to come to a little bit of a larger church.
So you were the only person. There wasn't even a secretary there.
No, it was a church of 60 to, I think our high water number was 90 at some point. So, but a lot of grad students, really a fun, interesting group. So I enjoyed it.
So when did you actually come to Portland Mennonite?
So 1999. You know, I was kind of getting to that point in my term there in Kansas. I knew I wasn't going to stay for 20 years. I knew I wasn't going to stay for many more. And I remember there's a little note in Mennonite Weekly Review, I'm sure it was, about this church in Portland. And I remember sitting at a computer, and it was Larry Hatter was the conference minister, and sending him an email thinking, well, let's find out what happens here. And it happened. So yeah, that was 1999. I remember coming out to candidate. It was Pentecost of 1999. Stayed up at Gail and Tim Monicum hosted us in their home. And then that August, we moved out here. I remember Joe Blowers, he was the chair of the table, calling me after the process. And I was in Kansas. It was hotter than blazes. And Joe called and offered me the position. I was super happy. What I remember is that he and his son, Seth, were getting ready to go backpacking, and they were going to be hiking on snow. And in Kansas in the summer, you cannot imagine there's a place in the world that has snow still on the ground. And I just thought, I really want to go to that place. So for a lot of reasons, I was very glad to accept the position.
Well, there are, like I say, so many more questions, but I just want to talk about briefly a couple of other things besides Portland Mennonite Church, where you are still the lead pastor. There are several others. We're in the process of a search right now for a new associate pastor. And so things are bubbling back again after the pandemic, especially. Mm-hmm. I know you've done some traveling, but is there still some place in the world that you would really, really like to go if time, money, anything was not an issue?
Oh, there are many places in the world I would like to go. I'd like to go trekking in the Alps. I'd like to go to Spain. If time and money weren't an issue, I would just eat my way around the Mediterranean. I'd start in Morocco and not stop till I got to Portugal. So I've always wanted to go to New Zealand, the Milford Track down there, go hiking in New Zealand. So yeah, I can think of a lot of places. I'm always glad to go to Hawaii. I mean, more and more, I think the carbon cost of that kind of travel is in the back of my mind more and more. So I think about travel a little bit differently these days, but there's plenty to see here in North America too. So,
and one other thing that I do know about you is that you really, really like baseball and you like a particular team. Can you tell us how that came about for you?
Well, yeah, growing up in Central California, the Giants were the team. You know, as a kid, everyone played baseball back then. So I would go to bed. I had a little transistor radio. I'd slide it under my pillow and listen to the Giants games. Well, I remember Lon Simmons. He had this baritone voice, the radio voice of Golden West Radio Network, I think it was. But that was, I mean, that was Willie Mays and Willie McCovey and Juan Marichal and Orlando Cepeda. And they were just great teams. We'd go over occasionally to a game. I can remember the smell of cigars as you'd go up to Candlestick Park. So, yeah. So I've been a Giants fan for a long time. Yeah, they're doing all right this year, so we'll see.
Well, Rod, thank you so, so much for taking the time to share some of your amazing stories with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. If something you heard raised questions or you discovered a connection, take the opportunity to reach out and continue the conversation. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.